Dude, we had a topic. Dude, what was it?
What?
Today is Friday, May 3rd, 2019, time for episode 82 of the Barnhart Podcast. And did you catch the latest Avengers movie?
Sure didn't. Did you?
I have no idea what this is. I see a whole lot of people on Twitter and other places talking about Marvel comic universe, this, that, or another thing. And it's like, is this like a competitor to Star Wars or something? It's like, I don't get it. Why would anybody care about this stuff? What is it? I really don't know.
Perpetual adolescence. We don't care because we're adults, my friend. There at a certain point, you just really stop having that be something that your life revolves around. You have an actual life with actual relationships and actual activities. And for, you know, lucky people like you, you've got a beautiful spouse and a house full of children. And for people like me, you just kind of, you know, do your little work and worship God and do your thing. And yeah, I don't know, who am I to judge and all that, but this absolute obsession with these comic books, literally comic books, and every movie is the same damn thing. And people say, oh, this is the Lord of the Rings of our generation. Yeah, no, it really, really, really isn't. I think I've seen a couple of them, and I guess there's one thing. In fact, it was the Iron Man movies, and the thing that I found, entertaining and admirable, if you could say anything, about the Iron Man movies was when I found out that Robert Downey Jr. had improvised most of his own dialogue. And at that point, you realize, oh, hey, Robert Downey Jr. is a not entirely unintelligent human being, because, you know, he said some funny stuff. But yeah, this business of this crap, people's lives just revolving around this. It's, yeah, perpetual adolescence. Sorry, can't get on board.
Okay, so a couple of points there. In terms of actors improvising their lines, it makes me think of the Christopher Guest mock documentaries or mockumentaries. Mm-hmm, and there was no script in those movies. They have talking points for each scene. Yep. And they hire people who were excellent ad-libbers. So mm-hmm. there is literally no script for those scenes. And they have no idea from one take to the next who's going to say what. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you're seeing something that is entirely spontaneous, which there's a tremendous quality to that. And I would imagine it's probably pretty hard to pull off. But the other thing that comes to mind also, you mentioned the Lord of the Rings for our generation. There is a place for literature and I guess the film equivalent thereof in terms of society, in terms of humanity. And, I don't know his, maybe it's not the right term, canonical status, but Dr. David Alan White, he used to give lectures every summer at the SSPX seminary up in Winona, Minnesota, back when it was in Minnesota. And he was a professor of English and literature. And I think a couple of people listening to the podcast were students at the university where he was teaching, back when he was teaching. But anyway, he had a talk on why it is essential for Catholics to study literature and even fiction. And I wish I had any clue where in the world I had the cassette tapes of where that was. Yes, cassette tapes. It's that old at this point. Yeah. I never got them translated over to CD or anything. But no, the whole point that there is a place for fiction, and it's not all about escapism and entertainment. And it reminds me of a sermon series I heard recently about, I forget what the priest exactly was going off on, but the larger theory was escapism, but I forget what exactly he was targeting that on. And the whole idea that it is an epidemic in modern life that people try to escape what's going on, whether it's escape their responsibility or escape from the seriousness of being an adult, of saving their soul, whatever it is. And we're going to get to that more in a little bit, but
yeah. It's the business of sitting and passively watching other people do, I guess, for lack of a better word, manly, heroic things. You know, this is in the same vein as my critique of the sports culture in you know, the modern American West, post-Christian, whatever you want to call it. That obsession with watching sports is basically just a futile attempt for people to fill that void, especially men, to fill the void of, since they're effeminate and they won't do anything about the best that they can do is sit on a sofa and watch other men do quote unquote manful things, which even that is a farce and a facade. Because I mean, for example, you look at professional football players, professional basketball players, whatever, they're all notorious for being massive fornicators. You know, it's not uncommon for a given professional athlete to have 7 kids by 7 different women or something like that. That isn't manful. That isn't any sort of authentic masculinity. There's nothing admirable about most of these guys' lives. All they're doing is, and I think the NFL, well, to a certain extent, the NBA too, but the NFL especially is just, you know, the guy runs the ball a few yards, scores a touchdown, and then engages in this hyper-exaggerated, you know, masculine warrior display, when in fact he didn't actually do anything. This would kind of segue into if we were going to have a discussion about, there's now, it just seems like every few days now, there's a story of some attempted shooter or active shooter somewhere. And people, I think, maybe are finally starting to wake up and realize that when there's an active shooter, you run at the son of a bitch, you know? And so now, within the last 10 days, there's been 2 or 3 stories of people running at an active shooter, getting shot, being killed, but saving a bunch of lives in doing so. So that is a manful, virile thing. The stuff that these athletes are doing, it's just a farce. It's a fraud. But it fills that gap. It fills that void. And I think it's the same thing with these movies. You know, just anything, people are desperate to see anything that looks like a manifestation of heroic virtue or anything like that, because there just isn't any in the culture. And they're certainly not going to look to themselves to try to do anything of heroic virtue. So, you know, let's go watch a movie that was written by committee in the space of, I don't know, 6 months. They probably figure out, all right, we're going to make another one of these damn Marvel. We're going to make another one of these in the comic book series. Let's sit down by committee, write some quote unquote script, okay, patch it together, do a bunch of special effects and CGI, and then, you know, just feed this to people, and they'll eat it up, thinking that, well, look, I'm masculine and virile because I'm watching these movies fake depicting people who in a fantasy realm are doing something virtuous and masculine. But then in real life, everybody just is completely effeminate, lays down and dies, runs and hides, et cetera, et cetera. And the other reason why, when you ask me, you know, did I go see this crap? You know, I laugh out loud, but I'm not giving those people any money. Are you kidding me? I mean, Hollywood is one of the most corrupt paradigms, structures that has ever existed in human history. No, I'm not going to go give them money. No.
What, Hollywood? Yeah, but what about Disney? They're so wholesome, and they own Marvel.
So wholesome.
Now.
Do they really? Well, there's yet another reason. Disney, that one of the biggest child sex abuse and pedophilia organizations, trafficking, or child trafficking, child prostitution. Did we talked about this in the last episode, didn't we? Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, Miley Cyrus.
That's
child sex trafficking. Just because those kids, and there's a bunch of boys too, just because they got pimped into this by their parents doesn't mean it isn't a species of child sex trafficking. You can get pimped by your own parents. Of course you can. So yeah, no, not playing at all.
Well, with regard to movies and sports, I would say that there's a bifurcation there. Let's talk about sports first. I would say that there is an element of, you know, folks who appreciate the saying in sports that sports doesn't develop character, it reveals character. And so people of character, men of character, can appreciate sportsmen who can operate or work through injury and adversity and achieve a victory with graciousness and sportsmanship. And of course, for those not so nobly minded, they see, oh, dude runs ball, we score, awesome, yay, win. And I think they probably are the ones who probably would be the most entertained by the Marvel movies. I don't know. I mean, I say this with full, you know, admittance that I'm a huge Star Wars fan. And there's a part of me that says, yes, but Star Wars is about an actual developed ecosystem of real literature. It's the hero's journey. It's not just, oh wow, big things go boom on screen. But really, things go boom on screen. So yeah, you know, I really can't claim the high ground there, no pun intended. But maybe we should go to another topic. So last episode we talked about I think it was tangential. I forget how this even came up. Just the whole idea of how people in a certain milieu talk the same way. And yes, milieu was the word of the last podcast. And I specifically mentioned the idea of the test pilots over at MIROC, which then became Edwards Air Force Base, that they all followed the speaking style of Chuck Yeager. And we got some interesting feedback from a couple of pilots, military pilots, in fact. And one was a P-3 pilot, and during his training, he said that part of the training of saying you have to consciously speak slowly and calmly when you're on the radio, it's for two purposes. First off, if you're all excited about something going wrong, nobody can understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And secondly, there's the mental discipline that if you force yourself to slow down and be calm, you will slow down and be calm, and as a result, you will be able to think more quickly, which reminds me of a saying I've heard and some other cases that are related to tier one groups, that slow, or was it slow is steady, steady is fast, or something like that. The whole idea, if you consciously slow yourself down when your natural instincts say speed up and be excited, you end up actually being a lot faster as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And the other email that came back was somebody who was worked around air traffic controllers, and they would speak with this very certain slow monotone voice, when not only when they are talking on the radio to the aircraft that are out there, but also to each other. But then if you talk to them about, hey, do you need your trash can empty, they suddenly became normal human beings. And it was a statement about the fact that when you were in role or in your character, nobody should know the difference between one person and another. What you're doing as an air traffic controller is essentially you safeguarding the safe operation of the airspace. And it's the same thing, you know, between the air traffic controllers on the ground and the pilots up in the air. They speak in a certain manner, and that's the way it's going to be mutually understood. And also because not everybody in the world speaks English, but English is the international language for air traffic control and for aviation. Yeah. It is something that you get used to a certain cadence and way of speaking, which for somebody who doesn't speak it every single day, even when you're riding in coach or business or even first class and you hear the pilot come over the PA, it may sound rushed and you may not understand what they're saying, but if you're on the ground as an air traffic controller, or I don't know, an enthusiast who loves to listen to recordings of air traffic controllers, this is going to sound very common. And so if you're used to the, I don't want to say a liturgical sense in a way, but if you're used to a certain vocabulary spoken in a certain way, even though it would be completely alien and unintelligible to everybody else, within your dialect professionally, it's completely understandable. Mm-hmm. So
almost kind of like chant, you know. To the untrained ear, it sounds, you know, the first time people hear chant, they're like, oh, what is that? And what in the world is that? But then pretty soon you can hear which psalm they're saying or whatever, and you can clearly pick it out. So yeah. And also, just I think we might have talked about this on the last episode. If you get all excited, you would probably get teased relentlessly. Because we were talking about Chuck Yeager, right? We talked about Chuck Yeager, and
yeah, I was specifically referring to the Tom Wolfe novel, Not a Few Good Men. It was
Right Stuff.
The Right Stuff. Mm-hmm. In fact, in that dialogue, talking about the way pilots talk, there was a war story from Vietnam where one of the pilots was freaking out all of a sudden on the radio channel because one of the North Korean MiGs got on his tail, and somebody else on the channel said, shut up and behave yourself and die like a naval aviator. In other words, be disciplined on the radio.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that there are quite a lot. There's a whole genre on YouTube of air traffic control recordings, and, they make one of the things that the government's actually doing that's an incredibly valuable thing is that they do these sometimes with really good computer animated reenactments of incidents, crashes, whatever. So you can kind of see what happened and how aviation accidents happen and things like that. And you would think, because, you know, in somewhere as big as the United States, there's probably pretty close to a civil aviation crash, even if it's just a little bitty Mooney or something like that, a little single engine private aircraft. There's a crash almost every day. And, you know, there's hardly any incidents of the pilot while his plane is crashing that you hear, you know, some guy screaming or anything on the radio. They just don't do it. You know, they fly or not fly the airplane into the ground, and most of them die in a certain silence. I don't know if they're screaming inside, you know, with the radio turned off, but They certainly don't broadcast their death or anything like that. That also reminds me of, it's been a few years ago now, but there was a female Southwest Airlines pilot, and something happened, and like one of the engines fell off of this plane, and there's a video recording of that whole incident. And she is just cool as a cucumber, and she, you know, she's just very calmly talking about, you know, shrill, shrieking harpies and all this. This chick was the opposite of this. And I don't know if she was Air Force Academy or what she was, but, you know, she's now a pilot for Southwest. And she's talking to air traffic control, describing the fact that, you know, the engine has just fallen off of the plane or something like that. And it just sounds like she's describing, you know, I need to go pick my kids up from softball. I mean, she is so completely unfluttered in any way. It's awesome if she were a dude. The fact that she's a chick and, you know, sounds young. She sounds like she's probably in her 30s or something like that. Just cool as a cucumber and lands the plane safely and everything. It's pretty remarkable how much damage an airplane can take and how little control that pilots can have of an airplane, and they still manage to put the thing on the ground safely. But I'll see if I can find that, and we'll put that in the show notes. But that's worth a listen, not only just because of the overall calmness, but the fact that it's a woman, and it's a proof that, you know, women, that the whole screaming, shrieking, panicking woman thing. Yeah, I have no patience for that. And, you know, women don't have to be that way. You can be composed and not emotional and keep all of that under control. Now, when you put the thing on the ground, you can burst into tears, I suppose, if you want to. But even then, you probably shouldn't. Healthy adult people should be able to regulate their emotions. You know, the whole emotional instability thing is a big red flag among adults, and it's something to look out for. And, you know, we see more and more that as the culture degrades, as people start taking antidepressants, pharmaceuticals, and this is probably going to end up being the segue into the main topic of the podcast, quote unquote, recreational drugs and all this, you're seeing more and more, you know, falling into emotional instability amongst adults and lack of faith and all of that. You know, if you don't have the faith, if something bad happens or something stressful happens, you are going to be more prone to panic and emotional outbursts because you don't have any way of dealing with suffering. You don't have a bigger picture. You don't have a larger context to put anything into. You're going to have an intrinsically narcissistic worldview that goes even all the way down to something as rudimentary as your own survival. You know, if you're at risk of death and you don't have a firm foundation, you are going to be panicky, scared, emotional, whatever. Whereas if you're emotionally sophisticated, you're not going to be. An example of this is during the French Revolution. The difference between King Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette being led to their execution, they were completely calm, they were completely dignified, prayerfully comported. Why? Because they were, in fact, Catholic people. They were believing Catholic people. They were flawed, certainly, but they had the faith. When the terror got to the end and the French Republicans, the bad guys, then started turning on each other and killing each other, which is what they always do. I guess a lot of those French revolutionaries who ended up themselves being led to the guillotine, the men were just shrieking, wailing, panicking, crying hysterically, all this kind of thing. Of course they are. They were by definition atheists, so they didn't have any way to deal with that. They had no way to control or check their emotions, and they had no greater context to put anything into. So they couldn't deal with their own mortality. So they were basket cases, basically. So it's something to be on the lookout for. You know, just remember that emotional stability, having an even keel, an even temper, definitely an indicator of, you know, definitely of sanctity, but just of being a together sort of a person just in general. And it's not virtuous to be overtly emotional and panicky, male or female.
Well, and on the topic of virtue, you walked right into this. I've been writing down these notes while you've been talking. Be not afraid. How many times does that show up in the scriptures? And yep. In terms of the opposite of that, we're talking about courage and fortitude. And I was talking with some folks at work who are actually trained master's degree level psychologists. And the whole idea, there's among computer programmers, there's this topic called imposter syndrome, that I shouldn't be here. I should be afraid of failure and all the rest. And I've never quite understood that. And one of the things that's fascinating to me about this is, like, I'm not that much better than, in fact, there are some people who are way better programmers than me who claim to have this imposter syndrome thing. And what makes me confused is, how is it you've got that and I don't? And the only common thread I can come to mind is something about military training, but that doesn't really answer it all. And so I was talking to this person who's got master's level psychology training, and she said that the big thing here is how you respond to fear. And I've seen it mentioned before that every soldier in combat experiences fear. How you respond to it is the difference between a hero and a coward. Okay, so if you're paralyzed by fear, that's I you know, you're going to be the coward type. And if it's the kind of thing where I'm going to overcome this, I'm going to look fear in the face, punch it between the eyes and go achieve something. Well, then that's the other direction as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Oh, and then the extreme on the other side is like, for example, there are people who do incredibly reckless things. There are people that have some sort of there's something wrong with their brain. And so they free climb up the side of buildings or up, you know, towers and things like that, and then take selfies of themselves and
or do wingsuit flying at like 10 feet off the ground.
Exactly. I mean, they just keep doing things until, you know, finally their luck, we don't believe in luck, but until their proverbial luck runs out and they die. And what they report is that they have absolutely no sensation of fear whatsoever. And when I lived in Colorado, this was an issue with young people, especially it's usually guys who had this, who would go up and do extremely reckless things on, you know, double black diamond or go off double black diamond skiing. And one of the things that they said is that they have something, some wire is crossed in their brain where the perception or the experience of what we would call pleasure and fear is somehow those wires get crossed. And so the only way that they can feel pleasure is by doing things that every other human being would be rightfully and naturally afraid to do and inhibited from doing. So, you know, like I said, doing daredevil type stuff, climbing things without a rope, et cetera, et cetera.
Kind of like an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It reminds me of the people, and no offense to marathoners who are listening, but there are people who will run 200 miles at a time simply to get and maintain that runner's high. And I don't think any of our listeners, and we do actually legitimately have a few marathoners listening, I don't think those folks go running 50, 100, 200 miles at a time. So I don't know. There's something around 14 miles. I understand that there's a natural runner's high, but it's the difference between having a cup of coffee and snorting a few lines of cocaine. I mean, I've never done the latter. Coffee in the morning, pretty much every day. But I did want to get back to one thing. You mentioned the female pilot, cool as a cucumber. Something that is all over YouTube. Go look at, and I forget the flight number, but Captain Sullenberger. He was in fact, there was a movie made about this, and Tom Hanks did the guy justice in the way he played the character. This guy, if you listen to the ATC recording of, you know, once they lost power and trying to figure out where they can put the thing down, he says, he's just completely, you know, as though he's going through a ground check. And there's just nothing going wrong. He's like, yeah, I'm going to put it down in the Hudson. And you can hear the air traffic controller saying, you're going to put it down where?
Yeah.
the ground person, you know, lost their cool faster than the pilot did. And everybody walked away from it. And I think probably all the luggage was saved too. I mean, this guy wasn't fazed one bit. You know, we're trying to climb out of LaGuardia, climb over New York. Oh, we lost both engines. Okay. Proceed to the checklist. What can we do? Start the APU, see if we can restart the engines, put on glide path toward the closest airport. And that, and again, it's one of these things that I talked about, you know, not having this imposter syndrome thing. And it's like, how in the world could this possibly have been trained out of me? And the one thing that, you know, I come back to in terms of military training is we don't train for the happy path. We train for, yes, we understand what the right, you know, what the happy path is, something programmers talk about, is if everything about your program goes correctly, if users do exactly what you expect them to do, then everything works. What if they, I don't know, put -5 in a field where you're expecting them to put a reasonable number? Mm-hmm. Well, that's not so happy path, and you have to account for errors. Well, with the military, you assume everything is going to go sideways and or pear-shaped or go wrong or get screwed up or whatever metaphor you want. And so, yes, you train through one time on happy path, and then the rest of the 10 times you run through this, it's okay, now you've lost this system, now you've lost that system, now you're flooding, now you've got no electricity. And it gets to the point where you just assume for all of your battle scenarios that you're going to lose everything. And it does remind me of the characterization of Stephen Pressfield in his book, The Fiery Gates. when he account when he it's an aggrandized version of the Spartans, but their training was so arduous that they wished war would break out so that they could actually have hot meals and enough to drink, because they literally had nothing to eat for the last 3 days of their exercises when they were doing drills preparing or doing training for war, whereas during war they actually it was much easier. Mm-hmm. So
it's it goes to the thought of, again, circling back kind of to where we started talking about perpetual adolescence and you know, childishness. A lot of people today don't have, I mean, I don't know if we should put a mild language alert on this episode, but you know, what we call it is having your shit together. And one thing that adults do is that, yeah, they do try to anticipate, prepare. I mean, obviously training for war is the taking it all the way to extreme, but just being an adult, just being a grown-up, you should sit around and think, what would I do if, you know, like you, super nerd, what would I do if I got fired from my job tomorrow? What would be the contingency plan? I would do this, 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 and this. Financially, I'd have to do X, Y, Z, you know. You just think a little bit, and it doesn't have to be super detailed, but just being an adult, being a responsible human being, you exercise in your mind, what would I do if, you know, some negative contingency happened. And I think one of the problems in today's society is that people are so childish, adolescent, feminine, that they just prefer to not think at all about negative contingencies. And then when something bad does happen, it does turn into the shrieking, panicking woman, except that's all the men. And so then everybody's running around waving their hands saying, oh my, there's nothing we can do. Oh, this is the end of the world. And there's no capacity, it seems to me, or very little, for people to just stop. All right, what's the situation? Tell me what the situation on the ground is. Give me information, and then to just formulate what a calm, measured response should be, because they have no practice whatsoever, because life is just adolescent escapism. So I encourage you just start thinking about, what would I do if there was a huge natural disaster, if I had my bank account swept, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is the least arduous thing you can possibly do, is just sit and think. And I think I've told this story before, but when I was apprenticing under the old man who taught me the cattle business, who taught me cattle marketing, one time, I think we were in the truck, we were driving somewhere, and I made some offhand comment, and I can't even remember what the context was, but the words "I'm bored" came out of my mouth somehow, some way. And he corrected me immediately and made the point that an intelligent human being should never be bored. There is always, always something to think about, always. So If you say that, if those words come out of your mouth, there is something wrong with you. Because in this life, if nothing, I mean, he was an atheist, so he's never going to be thinking about God, you know, any of these ideas. But his point, but it's absolutely true, and it carries across, is there's always something to be thinking about. You're thinking about contingencies, what your next business move is, thinking about mistakes you've made, how you can improve. And I really took that to heart and realized he was absolutely right, that ever claiming boredom is a sign of an intrinsically childish and narcissistic and unsophisticated mentality. And I think it's largely a function today, obviously, of the entertainment culture that we live in. You have to constantly be entertained. And we see social media addiction. That is 100% a function of that. The need to be constantly, constantly exteriorly entertained. The inability to just sit in stillness with yourself. That's why people today cannot comprehend how the contemplative vocation could even be a real thing. I mean, how could someone dedicate their life to just sitting in stillness and thinking about God? It's incomprehensible. It's obviously incomprehensible to the idiots in Rome and all the infiltrators, all of those people. They despise the contemplative orders and the contemplative vocation, that contemplative vocation. But the truth is that the contemplative vocation, authentically done, is the highest vocation. Spending your life just thinking about God, might one even say cultivating a personal relationship with our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, that is in fact the highest vocation.
That almost brings to mind the words from Scripture of Our Lady. We don't have many instances of her saying anything, but on a couple of occasions that she listened and kept the words of Christ in her heart.
Yep. Yep. Just stop and think about this. Think about what all of it means. And I mean, imagine how much she had to think about, you know. I think it's clear that she had, you know, interior locutions, so on and so forth. She had so much to just quietly sit, contemplate, ponder, think about. You look at art, and there are a lot of depictions of, and a lot of modern people are off put by these images and this iconography, but of, you know, our Lord, newborn baby, in the manger, whatever, and he's laying on the floor with nothing. You know, he's naked and he's a baby laying on the floor, and Our Lady is just adoring him. She's just staring at him. It's just that. It's that adoration. That's why going, if you have adoration, if you have a perpetual adoration chapel, there's quite a few parishes nowadays and more that have, you know, a perpetual adoration chapel with a little, you know, key code door lock, so that if you ask the priest for whatever the 5-digit PIN is for the, or code is for the door, that you can get into perpetual adoration. Or even if you just go into a church where Our Lord is reposed in the tabernacle, but not necessarily exposed in the monstrance, and you just sit there, and there's all kinds of anecdotal words of wisdom about people who, according to the outside world, seem to be, you know, completely uneducated, unsophisticated, certainly didn't have any degrees in theology or anything like that. And, you know, some priest would ask this 85-year-old man who was, you know, sitting in the church and was always seen sitting in the church just staring at the tabernacle, and say, you know, what are you doing? And old man would say, well, I just come here and I look at him and he looks at me, you know, but there's a deep, deep truth in all of that.
That's almost a verbatim reproduction of, I just wrote down in my notes, a link to the sermon series on mental prayer. And if I'm not mistaken, in that sermon series, this is happening in France, and it's a farmer and an illiterate farmer at that, where he comes in and prays, and the priest took note of him and asked him, it's like, what do you think? What are you saying to Jesus? I don't say anything. I just look at him and he looks at me.
Yeah.
You know, it's the essence of mental prayer. And the larger gist of that 3-part sermon series is that mental prayer is essential. It is absolutely essential for salvation. And if you constantly are in need of some sort of stimulation from the outside, mm-hmm. that means you don't have that interior life of mental prayer, that personal relationship with Christ, as you so aptly put it, mm-hmm. something that, darn it, you know, Protestants did steal something of value, or at least mimic or plagiarize something of value from the Catholic Church, and then we happen to forget it.
Yeah.
We need to have that personal relationship with Christ and Mary and the saints, the whole Trinity. Yes, but Jesus is the one who came to earth. He's the one who look at your crucifix. He died for you, and you're the one who caused him to die.
Yes.
Anybody who's listening to this podcast, you have sinned. You caused him to die. And think about, even if everybody else, what if Eve had never fallen, Adam had never fallen, and you were the only one to have fallen? Christ would still have come to earth.
Yep.
To die, to save you, even if you had to be the one to nail him to the cross in order to save you.
Yep.
Think about that.
And the other thing to remember is that this is another one that blows my mind, is that not only would he do it all for you alone, just you, but he would do it, his incarnation, his entire passion and death, he would do it as many times as you assist at the holy sacrifice of the Mass during your life. And the truth is probably more than that, let's be honest. So, you know, in these dark days, it's just so sad to watch, you know, people being scandalized by the goings on in Rome and all that. And people, you know, not going to Mass or complaining that, you know, even if it's in the context of a liturgical, you know, you have to be careful. I mean, we all want good liturgy, obviously. Obviously, we all want good liturgy. That goes without saying. But when people stop going to Mass because, you know, the architecture of the church is not up to their standards, or because the liturgy is not up to their standards, or even because of the Novus Ordo. And I think a lot of people are taken aback. And I always, every time I go into this, I get emails from people saying, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. But there, people are surprised that I hold this position. And in fact, I just had this conversation with someone in person, and it was on New Year's Eve, or right after this, just this past New Year's, because I always very much like to be at a midnight Mass or in front of the Blessed Sacrament exposed, something at midnight. I want to be with our Lord at midnight on New Year's Eve to bring the new year in. And so this past year, all that was available, all I could get to, was a Novus Ordo Mass. And someone remarked to me, and I said, I'm really surprised that you went to a Novus Ordo Mass. And I said, listen, we all need to be, circling back, recall, we all need to be thinking about and preparing ourselves for when the time comes, and it probably is going to come, when we do not have the old Mass available to us, certainly not on a daily basis like we do now. And we need to be mentally anticipating and preparing for this and getting our heads around this. And, you know, the thing you have to remember is that if it is a valid Mass, if the Eucharist is confected, if the Holy Sacrifice is offered and immolated, it's Calvary. It's Calvary. As you so beautifully put it, Super Nerd, either our Lord is at the Mass as in triumph, which means good liturgy, or he's there at the pillar, or he's there nailed to the cross. That's bad liturgy. And what you have to remember, and you know, when this light bulb went off over my head, and it's been a while ago now, it's like, here's the key. The most horrific, awful, in a sense, sacrilegious, blasphemous Mass that has ever happened was Calvary itself. People milling around. Can you imagine the taunts that were being screamed and hurled at our Lord
as by the high priests of the valid religion of the time?
Yep. Taunted. And can you imagine what the Roman soldiers were saying? I mean, you know that they were saying horrible sexual type things, just absolutely disgusting. You know that our Lord was being subjected to that. Are you going to tell me that if you had been there, if you had been one of the disciples this nearly 2,000 years ago now, that you would have walked off, you would have left Calvary in a huff because it wasn't sufficiently, you know, reverent, because there was not a prayerful silence or something like that. You know, no, of course not. You fall on your knees like Mary Magdalene, and you are there, and you're there as Our Lady was there, standing at the foot of the cross there. You're not going anywhere. Not going anywhere. That's what Satan wants you to do.
91.5% of the apostles did split.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Can you imagine the regret? I mean, Peter first and foremost among them, but can you imagine the regret, the shame, the embarrassment? Imagine when they heard that, you know, Mary Magdalene came and told them all that I've seen him. He's resurrected. He's alive, et cetera, et cetera. Can you imagine the combination of certainly joy that he was resurrected and that he was alive, but can you imagine how they all felt, all the other, the remaining 10, because Judas is dead, and John was there at the foot of the cross, so there's the 10 remaining. Can you imagine the sense of shame that they felt, knowing that they were going to have to face him, and knowing that they had run off and they had not been there? I guess bittersweet is the right word to use.
For the 10 who left and ended up being redeemed, I mean, obviously Judas is not among them, they did get to make good on their redemption and their commitment to Christ by giving their life in martyrdom. Mm-hmm. And with John, who never left, he was given the palm of martyrdom, and he willingly went to what would have been his martyrdom,
yep,
of being boiled in oil, but except he came out with, you know, saying his skin was as youthful as a baby, and it looked, mm-hmm, like he was 20 years younger when he came out of the boiling oil. Which, that alone, I mean, this is something that should be a no-brainer, instant kill to everybody. Mm-hmm. And the Romans who were, or I think it was Romans, tried to put him to death. They're like, wait, what just happened here? And they were struck. So many of them who meant to execute him were converted. That's what happens when you're faithful to Christ. When you have that personal relationship that you don't turn your back on, you will bring Christ to everybody else. And if you're not afraid of death, you'll bring Christ to people all the more.
Yeah. And the other thing to be said about the remaining 10 was that they got to spend Holy Saturday with Our Lady. And one can only imagine what she did on Holy Saturday and what those dynamics were of what was going on as she was there holding them all together. You know, she was the center of it all there on Holy Saturday. And I suppose in a certain sense, it had to have been discussed. I mean, they had to have discussed it with her. Something had to have been said about the fact, yeah, I'm really sorry I wasn't there, you know? I mean, and what would she have said? Would she have been nasty and you all suck and blah, blah, blah? No, of course she, of course she didn't. She was, you know, full of grace as she is, means also full of charity. And you can only imagine the compassion that she had and what she said and what she did and how she held them all together on Holy Saturday so that, yeah, on Sunday, they were ready to face him. And good point about St. John and the boiling oil. And I think we've mentioned this before, but if you ever get to make a pilgrimage to Rome, it is worth it because you can go to the spot where the boiling pot of oil was, because of course there's a church there, because there's a church to absolutely everything that happened in the New Testament. But it's right there in Rome. It's right there, in the walls. I think it's in the walls. It's called the Latin Gate, I think. And you can take a cab and you can go to this church, and there's a little kiosk right there. And you look at this little kiosk and say, what's that? And walk up and read the didactic. And it says, oh, inside of here, and they open it up every once in a while, inside of here is the pot that they tried to boil St. John in. And it's just, you know, for Americans who are so, have no physical connection to these things that happened in the New Testament, to be physically confronted with the reality of all of these things. Like, I'm standing right here at the pot, you know, here it is. That's one of the awesome things about making pilgrimage to Rome, is getting to be in those places and be confronted viscerally with the realness of all of it. So if you ever get to go to Rome and you have time, you just go make pilgrimage to the pot, and not the marijuana pot, but the iron pot, the boiling pot.
If you ever get a chance to go to Europe in general, I would imagine, especially Italy, especially around Rome, there have got to be, you can't go more than 5 or 6 meters without going over somebody's relics or someplace where a saint died. I've heard that in France, the relics are everywhere in the shrines. They used to be everywhere. And the French Revolution did away with a lot of them, and the Muslims are doing away with the rest of them. And then there are fires doing away with some more. But that all over Europe, it was Christendom. Yeah. There was definite worship of Christ in the authentic sense. And we're almost
real saints, not fake political saints, real saints.
Absolutely. And let's see, we're almost an hour into this podcast and we haven't even gotten to the topic that we said we were going to get to off the top. Going to the pot, but marijuana style. Yeah. I'll let you take over at this point.
Yeah. So marijuana has kind of, This just cropped up, you know. I always say my blog just kind of writes itself, you know. You don't, if I make plans about, oh, well, this week I'm going to write about blah, 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 and blah, and then you end up never writing about any of that because current events happen and things land in your email box. And it turned out this past week it was marijuana, of all things, and specifically talking about how modern marijuana use and legalization of marijuana and the instance of paranoid schizophrenia, those two things are completely correlated. And talking about how incredibly potent the marijuana today and the marijuana that's being sold out of these legalized pot stores in Denver and so on and so forth, how this stuff is just way, way, way stronger than anything that the baby boomer loser hippies were smoking in the 60s. And we've received a tremendous amount of feedback from people. I've got more, I'm going to post some of these letters and feedback because you hear so much pro-marijuana propaganda. It's just really interesting to read this feedback, this real life anecdotes and experiences of people who have had, you know, dealt with this in terms of their kids, who have dealt with this in terms of themselves, and are wildly anti-marijuana after having to deal with all of this. And I think there's a risk because there's a lot of overlap, it seems to me, in trad Catholic circles with libertarianism. You know, there's kind of this hybrid, non-atheistic, socially conservative species of libertarianism. And one of the things that I discovered about libertarianism, looking at it, you know, 10, 15 years ago, as you know, one was still looking at following, had no desire to ever run for office or anything, but was just still following day-to-day politics very closely, is that you start, you know, libertarian things start cropping up. And what you very quickly realize is that what most libertarians are about was about weed. I mean, that was the number one issue for most of them, is they wanted they smoked pot and they wanted it legalized. And then everything else, all of the, you know, get the government out of my hair and lower taxes and all that kind of stuff, that was all completely secondary to the fact that they wanted pot legalized. And that was the agenda. And that, you know, I mean, obviously, huge red flag, massive red flag, because altering your mind chemically like that is, it's gravely sinful. And no, pot and alcohol are not the same, because you can sit down and you can have a glass of wine with your dinner and you're not just completely stoned. With marijuana, the point is to get stoned. That's the entire point. There's no such thing as, you know, imbibing marijuana to no effect. There's no point to that. And so,
well, as St. Thomas says, you can drink to the point of hilarity. And I don't know that there's and I say this with complete lack of understanding of, I've never done any drug stronger. Let me think about this. Caffeine might be the strongest one. Caffeine or chocolate. I'm not sure which one's stronger. I've never done pot or coke or any of that stuff. So I don't know if it's
prescription antidepressants or anti-anxiety, because, you know, I think we need to be grown up about this and admit that that all needs to be put basically in the same category. Just because you get a little piece of paper from a guy or gal in a white coat and you trot off to some Walgreens or something and they hand this stuff to you and you pay for it completely legally on your credit card, it doesn't mean that these drugs are not in the same classification. I've known people who've become helplessly addicted to Vicodin and Valium and all this stuff. And I know people who pop Xanax and Prozac and crap like that as a way of just, you know, not dealing with life.
I've heard the term used, suburban addicts. And it's something that didn't even exist 10 years ago or 20 years ago. But people who are on these opioids, and I forget the exact numbers off the top of my head. I want to say it was Dr. Phil on the Joe Rogan podcast talking about the statistics of people who go on things like oxycodone, that if they stay on it for 7 days, there's a certain threshold, like 12% will be hooked for life. But after 4 months, it's almost like 50-50. And just the whole idea of people, you know, these are the legal over-the-counter, but prescription drugs, and people will, you know, get hooked on this stuff, and they will, you know, they will renew their prescriptions as much as possible, invent new reasons to get them. And of course, when the doctors, if they have a doctor who is willing to say, look, you've got a problem, I need to cut you off, they then transfer over to opium at that point.
Well, and there's also a street trade in this stuff. I know someone whose spouse, I mean, textbook suburban situation, you know, and the spouse got hooked on this, eventually ended up going to the street, eventually ended up running up like six figures in credit card debt, servicing all of this. And I think, you know, people get stuck in it because get into it initially, I guess it's some sort of a lot of people start with it with some sort of a legitimate pain-killing issue, you know, back or whatever it is. And it has that air of legitimacy because you get the first prescription from an honest-to-goodness allopathic doctor, not some witch doctor, not anything like that. You get it from an honest-to-goodness, completely legit allopathic doctor, and then it just spirals out of control. And it just, I guess it just turns people into complete zombies. They just don't care. Talk about acedia. We've been talking about the vice of acedia. It's, you know, it's chemical acedia, and it becomes addictive. And
well, I would say that the chemical addiction might lead to acedia. I wouldn't say they're necessarily the same thing, though.
Right. Yes. The chemical addiction leads to the acedia, but it manifests that. It just, people dropping out of everything, dropping out of life, dropping out of basically engaging with their spouse, engaging with their kids, sitting in front of a television, sitting in front of a video game console, and just becoming addicted to that zombie-like state of not having to think about or deal with anything. And they tend to, they're still high enough functioning that a lot of them still maintain their jobs and so forth. But it's a horrible, horrible, horrible thing. So
it goes back to not having a personal relationship with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people are taking drugs and doing, whether it's drugs or alcohol or whatever, you're doing this to cover up pain, suffering. If you had a relationship with Christ, wouldn't this kind of be fixed?
Yeah. And it also has always seemed to me that it's a species of self-loathing. I'm sure this is going to sound quite conceited. I don't mean it to, but I've always rather liked myself, and I don't want to alter me. I don't want to alter my personality. I don't want to alter who I am. I certainly don't want to imbibe any sort of a chemical that would ever do such a thing. That's a horrifying thought. I mean, it's a parallel sort of an idea, because we were talking about this on the last episode of plastic surgery. Can you imagine how far gone a person has to be to look in a mirror and think to themselves, man, I need to go find someone who will cut on my face and alter my face? It, for any sane person, this is just terrifying and incomprehensible, including for people who are aging and who no longer have the beauty, the youth of, you know, when they were in their 20s. Still, the thought of having someone cut on your face and alter your physical appearance is horrifying. How much more horrifying should it be to think to yourself, I not only do I want to change my body, my physical appearance, and something so intrinsic to me as a rational intellect with a body person, as human beings are, and want to cut on my face, I want to alter who I am inside my mind. I want to alter my brain, and that goes to the deepest core of who you are. What in the world are these people thinking? I want nothing to do with this. You know, if I do feel some emotion of anxiety, which, I mean, this is a bad example because I never do, but but if I were to feel something that would be classified, I guess, as a negative, unpleasant emotion, well, that's actually part of life, and maybe that's to some extent appropriate to what my situation is, and it's a good thing, you know, and good can come out of the fact that we do sometimes rightly feel what are classified as negative emotions. In fact, now that I say this, here's a movie that I think this is the last movie that I saw in a theater. It's been years ago now. It's a little Pixar movie. I can't remember what it's called, but it's about a little girl and her four categories of emotion. And the four emotions are depicted and are the main characters in this story. And, you know, they're seen like inside of her brain in a little control center. And, you know, they have to regulate her mood and this, that, and the other. And the entire point of the moral of the story, so to speak, is the fact that sadness is one of the four. It's essential that sadness be able to manifest, because that's how you push forward. And the protagonist of these four emotions is joy. And joy is initially wrongly trying to constantly suppress sadness, and never let sadness manifest in any way. And you come to the climax of this movie, and it is in fact sadness that saves the day. And the girl is, I think, 11 or 12 years old. And this instance, oh, and what was the context? She had moved, and she was very, very sad. The little girl, her family, her parents had moved, and moved. I think they moved to San Francisco because one of the things that was very traumatic for the little girl is that they went to get pizza in San Francisco and it was broccoli pizza. And she was just like, this is awful. It was this that like sent her over the cliff. Because even the pizza was bad in San Francisco, the broccoli pizza. And so, yeah, I mean, these things, it's not good to not be a fully, robustly, emotionally effective human being. If your emotional palate is in any way curtailed, including things like the ability to be sad, or if you're constantly trying to medicate that away somehow, it's profoundly disordered. There are times when, boy, something happens and you should be sad. The ability to be sad is derived from the ability to love. People who can't love can't ever be authentically sad. It's utterly essential. But again, like you said, Super Nerd, the faith is lost in most people. No personal relationship with Christ, and then so all you're left with is that you just turn into this almost animalistic body running around, and all you can do is try to satisfy your bodily appetites and do anything you can to escape from any sort of authentically human sadness, et cetera, et cetera. And the lengths that people will go to now in this culture to do that is just terrifying. And I think pot smoking is one of those things.
Either animalistic or plastic. And it's the idea of I'm going to even deny the transcendence of what human nature is, and I'm going to simply sink to the level of animal nature, and that's going to be it. Or I'm going to say, I don't like the way things are going. I'm going to go in a plastic sense, whether it's literally plastic surgery like we talked about in the last episode, or whether it's chemical enhancement or some kind of, you know, better living through mental chemistry. It's the same root cause going different directions, but the third direction is the right way to think about it, and that's to look at Christ on the crucifix. It's supposed to suck. Adam and Eve screw this up for us, and the only way we can make it right is to embrace the fact, as St. Paul says, the sufferings of Christ are made complete by what we add to it, which, you know, to the Protestant sounds weird because we are covered in the grace of Christ and that's it, is according to the Protestants. But go reread St. Paul. The sufferings of Christ are made complete in the works of the saints.
Yep. And people, that's another reason why this euthanasia thing is just exploding, because there is zero capacity to comprehend in any way, any notion of physical suffering at the end of life of any kind. And so sadly, it's just, you know, for now it's book your flight to Switzerland, but it's getting to be, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, it's going to get to the point where I'm convinced that euthanasia is going to be the next big thing in reality television in the United States, that people will sign up to have the last X weeks, X months of their life documented as part of a reality entertainment paradigm, of which the culmination will be their self-slaughter. And it will be wildly popular, and it will be peddled as, you know, incredibly emotional and sophisticated and tear-jerky, and of course, you know how it's going to be peddled, is that these people are heroic and their self-slaughter is this incredibly beautiful thing. Oh yeah, I guarantee you that is going to happen easily within the next 10 years.
Okay, so I'm sure you're familiar with the organization called the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Yes.
It's the terminally ill children who are going to die very soon. In fact, when my wife and I went out to San Diego, when we were flying back home, they made a big announcement in the terminal that there was somebody flying from San Diego to Orlando as part of the Make-A-Wish Foundation, and that Southwest and Disney and everybody else who had anything to do with this was donating everything for this kid to go to Disney World. And I'm thinking about what you're saying here about the whole idea of reality TV. It's almost like make a death wish, except mm-hmm. they're probably going to phrase it in a positive sense. So it's going to be make a life wish, help this person end their life in a positive yeah. sense.
Yep.
Oh, not that I'm offering consulting for TV networks. You all go figure this out on your own.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I think they already have. I think they already have. And it's coming in this culture of suicide, just that feminine incapacity to reconcile any sort of physical suffering whatsoever, and viewing physical suffering as degrading, a betrayal by God, et cetera, you know. And well, I'm going to shake my fist at God, and I'm not going to let him get me. I'm not going to let him, you know, cause me to lose my dignity, because they use that word all the time, dignity, death with dignity, death with dignity. No, it's precisely the fact that we are created in the image and likeness of God and have this capacity to suffer. And for incredible amounts of good to come out of that suffering. It is because we are human. It is precisely because we are human. We're not animals. So, you know, death with dignity. Now let me go be put down, literally put down like a dog. The internal contradiction in it is so obvious and so stark. But, you know, people are so blind today, so morally, intellectually blind. Sin makes you stupid. You know, you don't honor the Sabbath, which is like the bare minimum. All right, right there, you're in a state of sin. You're living your entire life like that. Then layer on top of that your fornication, your self-abuse, your multiple marriages, quote unquote. Never mind getting into species of perversion, mendacity. That's one of the things I just marvel. And I was discussing this with someone earlier this week, is I still am surprised by it, and I never want to not be surprised by it. But the capacity for people to lie is just, it's just continually shocking. But that's a good thing. And the point I was making with the person I was discussing this week is you can never, ever allow yourself to fall into the trap where you start assuming the worst about everybody and, you know, say, well, this new person that I met, this is a liar. Because this is about, this goes to, like, for example, Islamic culture, where lying is just expected. It's ubiquitous. The entire culture is built on lying. If you go into a market in an Islamic city, it is absolutely 100% expected and understood that if you try to do business with anybody in a market context, that they are trying to screw you over. They are lying to you through their teeth, and it's understood. This is a massive difference between Christian and obviously Islamic culture, is this expectation of mendacity.
This is even mentioned, or it's even highlighted in the movie Casablanca, where I forget the female character's name. She's going out just, you know, milling around in the marketplace, and somebody tries to sell her something for 120 francs. And when Rick walks up and starts talking to her, he's like, oh, for friends of Rick, special price. And that goes all the way down to 15 francs before she says, I'm just not interested at all. So the whole idea
yes,
exactly. So the whole idea of the mendacity there. And of course, they'd never explicitly said that was an Islamic culture, but come on, this is Casablanca, Algiers, or
is it Morocco.
Morocco. It's a Muslim country.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a Muslim culture. And, you know, it's just, I'd really like to be able to be, you know, face to face with someone who's just caught in a lie, who's lying through their teeth, and be able to have, you know, to like hit a pause button and be able to then in that moment stop and have a separate removed conversation in which they were being honest and say, okay, what are you feeling right now? in your physically as you're standing there lying. And again, this is kind of a like a fantasy conversation, because again, we've hit pause on time and now we're having a completely honest, forthright conversation. What do you feel right now? Do you feel that gnawing feeling in the pit of your stomach, right underneath your sternum, that that tightness when, because you're lying? Do you feel that? I feel that when I lie. Even I had, there's one context. There's a person who I can't, that I deal with, and I can't understand. It's really hard to understand them when they speak. And it got to the point where I was constantly, you know, having to confess that this person asked me, did you understand what I just said? And just in order to not have life drag out into just an agonizing thing, I would lie and say, yes, I understood you, even though I didn't 100% understand what they said. But it was a lie. I mean, they asked me, did you just understand what I said, you know, through this very, very thick accent? And I lied and I said, yes, I understood what you said. And, you know, it finally got to the point where, you know, I was in the confessional. I said, this happens all the time because, you know, I'm around this person all the time. And the priest finally just said, you know, it's a venial sin. Try not to do it, but understand that this is a venial sin and you don't have to, you don't necessarily have to sacramentally confess this every time. I'm like, okay, all right, I understand. But I mean, you see the point. But even with something as seemingly benign, I guess you would call that a white lie or something like that. When you say something that is untrue, there should be like a physical response inside of your body, that feeling in the pit of your stomach, you know, just that cringy, awful feeling. With Catholics, I would be fascinated to know, as you are standing here lying, now tell me the truth. Are you going through a calculus right now in your head, telling yourself, yes, I'm lying. I know I'm lying, but I can go to confession on Saturday. So yeah, the whole notion of presuming upon God's mercy. Okay, I get to go to confession on Saturday. This is Wednesday. So that's 3 days between when I'm telling this lie. But I mean, what is going through your mind? What is this calculus that you are going through? What are you physically feeling? What's going consciously through your head? It's morbidly fascinating in a way. It's truly a, you know, the ultimate in human psychology. What are you thinking? What are you thinking?
When it comes to the Eighth Commandment and lying, or the Protestants number them differently. So if you're not Catholic, I'm sorry, that it's a different number. But in terms of lying, this is something where there is no legitimate, mitigation. A lie is a lie is a lie is a lie. It's never authorized for any reason whatsoever, as opposed to thou shalt not kill, which I've heard it might be a mistranslation from thou shalt not commit murder. But the idea of you are allowed to take a life when it is justified.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody is trying to kill you or your family or somebody, and the only way to stop it is to actually take their life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously it's a narrow, you know, you've got to be there and understand it to interpret it. In terms of honoring your father and mother, you know, don't disobey. You have to disobey unlawful commands or a command that it would be sinful. But when it comes, and even theft to a certain extent is mitigated to, if you are in such dire need that you literally will starve to death if you can't eat, the natural law and the idea of absolute ownership does break down to the point that absolute need to maintain life supersedes somebody's right to, you know, hoard their stuff. And that's a more advanced topic than I'm even prepared to try to defend at the moment. But there are mitigations to the thou shalt not steal. But in terms of telling a lie, there is never a justification. A white lie is a sin, period. Mm-hmm. It might be a venial sin, but there is never a justification to lie. Now, there is mental reservation. Mm-hmm. And one of the examples that I heard a priest give once, it was, for example, during the Second World War, the SS shows up at your door and says, are there any Jews here? Well, we're standing here on the front porch. So if you say, no, there are no Jews here. Now, are you talking about my attic right now?
Yeah.
Or are we talking about my front porch? That's mental reservation.
Talking about the crawl space or right here on the porch? Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I mean, it's mental reservation. Now, this doesn't get you out of... You can't claim mental reservation if you're called for a witness in court, because you have to swear to tell the whole truth, mm-hmm. and nothing but the truth. And that rules out mental reservation.
Yeah.
But in terms of lying, there is never any justification. So white lies are sins. There may not be mortal sins, but they're still sins.
Yeah.
I just want to point that out.
Yeah, absolutely. And
not that you didn't know that, but.
Well, yeah, it's absolutely true, because remember, God himself is truth. Truth is a person, capital T. I am the way, the truth, and the life. So if you say anything that is not the truth, that is, in a sense, an attack on our Lord himself. So even if it's something, you know, like... Great Aunt Betty asking if you liked her hot dog and beet casserole or something like that. If you say yes, it's not true. I mean, you had to choke it down and fight your gag reflex. It's not true. I guess my advice in a situation like that is learn the art of the non-committal, you know, and with a non-committal head nod. That's kind of, it's not a shake no, but it's not a nod yes. It's just kind of a weird diagonal, you know. There
it
are.
It was the most delightfully interesting use of beats I've ever encountered.
Creative, exotic. Yeah. There are things that you can say that are.
It wasn't
that are not
what
lies.
I would have expected.
It was not what I expected. That, and you know, certainly it's not. You don't want to hurt dear Aunt Betty's feelings, great Aunt Betty's feelings, and she's spent money and gone to this effort to prepare this absolute horrific monstrosity that she's tried to feed to you. You don't want to hurt her feelings, obviously, but you just can't lie, because when you lie, you're attacking our Lord. And in a certain sense, imagine if you've got little kids around you and little kids see you telling these white lies. That is going to scandalize them, in the sense that they're going to start thinking, oh, okay, it's all right. In certain contexts, it's okay to lie. And then, especially with children, the thought starts occurring to them, especially if they're savvy and precocious youngsters. I just saw my parent, aunt, uncle, older sibling, whatever it is, respected adult friend, I just watched them lie. What else have they been lying to me about? Are they lying to me about when we go to church? Are they lying to me about Jesus? Are they lying to me about the Eucharist? And this is my quasi-annual Santa Claus lecture. You don't lie to your kids, even about Santa Claus. No, some old man did not break into our house last night and leave those presents under the tree. That is a lie. Don't do that, because when your kids find out that, no, Santa Claus wasn't breaking into the house and leaving the presents and eating the cookies and drinking the milk and blah, 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 it's in the context. It's in the context of the church itself. It's in the context of the feast of the Nativity of our Lord. And it's all built on a lie. What are you thinking? Don't lie to your kids. Don't lie to them, because it attacks faith. It attacks the ability to have faith, the ability to trust. It's no good. Don't do that. And so where do we start with this? Oh, mendacity and people lying, and what are they feeling? What is their visceral response to all of this? And the other point I wanted to make is about there's a large problem with what I refer to as within the church as pious lying. And by that I mean, and it's usually women who do this, it's usually older postmenopausal women who think that it's okay to lie if it's something that they perceive to be pious. So I think a lot of the instances of the so-called, you know, visionaries of the Western Church in the 20th and 21st century, that a lot of that stuff started out as either, you know, some woman having a hot flash or something, but then it turns into this pious lying thing that, oh, look, people's faith is being edified by the fact that I'm saying that I'm having visions of the Blessed Virgin or something like that. And they justify it in their minds by that. And then they start getting convinced of their own lies, and it snowballs and snowballs and snowballs. And you end up with things like Veronica Lukin at Bayside and things like that, where it's just obvious that she's completely making this stuff up, but she really thought that she was doing something good because, you know, people would come and pray. A lot of the instances of things like, you know, statues crying oil and stuff like that, a lot of it is con artists and, you know, premeditated malicious fraud. Some of it, a percentage of it, is this pious lying. People thinking, well, if I do this, this will get people to pray the rosary. This will incite, you know, this will inflame people's hearts with love of God, love of the church, love of Our Lady, whatever. So it's okay for me to do this because it's going to increase people's faith and people's piety. No, absolutely, absolutely not. No, no lying. And yeah, go to confession and yeah, hearken to Super Nerd's words, even with regards to white lies. Better safe than sorry. Do everything you can. Put forth the very, very best effort you can, as with anything else, to not commit that sin of bearing false witness in any circumstance. Because I think you're right now that we're sitting here discussing it. If you sensitize yourself into believing that it's okay in one context, then it becomes okay in another context. You'll just, and it's a slippery slope that you start. So don't do that. Don't do that.
The best case scenario that can come out of the vision example that you gave, I actually know of a couple who wanted to go to, because they'd heard so many good things, as many people have, about Medjugorje.
Sure.
And they decided they want to go on a pilgrimage there, but they also went through Italy and some other places in Europe. And the wife noticed some women wearing veils and kneeling for communion, and they decided, hey, that's a very pious practice. We'll pick that up. And when they went back home to the United States where they're from, they started doing, you know, kneeling for communion, and she was wearing a veil. And the priest said, "You're not one of these trad people now, are you?" And they looked at him like, "What do you mean?" And through that discussion, they found out about a fraternity of St. Peter Chapel right across town. And once they found out about that, they went and they became trad, and they've never looked back, as far mm-hmm. as I know. It's been a few years since I've talked to them. I should probably make contact with them again and see how they're doing. But, no, it's in a case like that, if you're sincerely trying to have that personal relationship with Christ, like we talked about before, even in spite of the other circumstances, grace will win. I mean, God can write straight with crooked lines. We talked about that last podcast as well.
Yep. So. And where sin abound, grace abounds all the more, which that applies directly to Medjugorje, which was conceived and founded as a fraud in the run-up to the war that was getting ready to break out over there. They said, okay, we're going to do this, and we're going to do some economic stimulus, and we're going to get ourselves kind of pre-positioned for this war that's about to break out. I mean, you look at the early Medjugorje the things that Our Lady was supposed to have said. And it's blatantly, blatantly obvious that it is a pure fraud. I mean, she's saying things like God values all religions equally and things, no way. And she's talking about soccer. She's talking about, you know, soccer tournaments and soccer matches. It's obviously transparently a fraud, but it's undeniable that people have converted and reverted, especially a lot of reversions have come out of the Medjugorje thing, but that doesn't make it okay. That does not make it okay. That's just a testament to God's goodness and how merciful he is and how he will, as Supernerd just said, right straight on crooked lines and cause good things to come out of, you know, out of bad, where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. But it doesn't make it okay. It does not make it okay.
And so, where the good comes from, it the good, you know, people had goodwill to begin with, and they were trying to express their love for Our Lady and Christ, and they might have been, you know, deceived by somebody, maybe even a priest, that this is the way to do it, and God will see their good intentions and raise them in grace.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I don't know. You want to call it? What's our time? Where are we at? We got to be at about an hour and a half.
We're just over an hour and a half. And it's funny. We nominally, this was going to be about, or the topic that we were going to talk about was marijuana. And I had a couple of interesting, a few stories that came in, but we can save these for another time. I'm sure this is evergreen, no pun intended. Yeah. We can come back to it.
And keep an eye on the blog, because I have received several emails that are really good and informative, and I'm going to post them because they need to get out there, and y'all need to read these things and not be deceived by this whole especially medical marijuana lying culture about this about this stuff, and especially with regards to your kids, your grandkids, your nieces and nephews who are being bombarded by this as much as they're being bombarded by pornography and things like that. And the horror stories that people are telling and how Big Pharma seems to be tied into all of this. Oh, shocker there, you know, and how the New World Order really clearly is tied into all this, how this is very much on the Soros agenda to just get people stoned basically all the time, because that makes people easier to control. And we see this in Islamic cultures too, that, you know, Afghanistan, places like that, you know, with all that opium production and everything, people are just stoned a goodly percentage of the time. Makes people easier to control, makes people dumb, makes people, you know, easy to manipulate, easy to control. Just shun this chemical crap as much as you possibly can. They're obviously, I'm not anti-pharmaceuticals. I'm not anti-medicine at all. In fact, I'm a big fan of genuine allopathic medicine and the technological advances that we're making in the medical field and amazing pharmaceuticals that are emerging, so on and so forth. But good grief, some of this stuff is obviously evil, sinister, sinister, sinister. And drug companies, they're at the root of so much evil, including economic evil in our culture today, that after the triumph of the Immaculate Heart, there's going to be some big changes that's going to have to be made with regards to the pharmaceutical industry.
There's going to have to be a fundamental reset there. And I didn't even get into the whole idea of medical marijuana and the idea that, even though I've never smoked or consumed marijuana or THC in any sense whatsoever, I will concede that if I, for example, was dying of cancer and I could not eat anything, it's my understanding that THC can actually help restore your appetite. It's not so much it's going to cure you, it's going to help you not be as miserable at the end of your life. And okay, flip a coin, yes, you can either embrace that suffering and unite it to Christ's passion and purge your sins at that point, or you, in the same sense that you could take a legitimate painkiller and you know, help you, you know, calm your nausea and eat something. You know, if you have cancer, this isn't really the conversation we're getting at. It's people who are normally nominally healthy and looking for some excuse to go smoke the herb.
Exactly, which the vast majority of it is. And, you know, we've moved beyond that now, where the medical thing, that song and dance isn't even necessary in places like Colorado. And it's just completely legal. And they're gonna move towards that, where it's just totally wide open. Whoever wants it, I don't know, it must be, is it 18 or 21? It would be so ironic if it were 18, that if the drinking age were 21 and the pot smoking age was 18, I don't even know.
It's 21, but this also gets into a secondary argument. I can't remember which podcast or audiobook I heard it from, that in terms of brain development, the brain doesn't stop developing until about the age of 25. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the additional complicating factors. If you get into any kind of addictive behavior, whether it's alcohol or drugs or pornography or anything, if this begins before the age of 25, your ability to kick it is almost impossible, as opposed to if you were to encounter this after the age of 25, which also strongly argues for the idea of maybe the voting age should not happen until you're at least 25. You know, let's just make it 30 to be safe.
Voting. Uh-oh, next episode is about monarchy.
Well, there have been some pretty craptastic monarchs too. So I'm not going to say monarchs are secure to everything.
No, it's not. It's not the answer to everything. But at least you know who to kill if things go sideways. So well,
exactly. I mean, I definitely love the idea of the Roman dictator, who was. I make this argument to people that I talk to about at work about politics, that y'all would be the most happy if I was the dictator for a while. And they look at me like I'm crazy. It's like, no, think about this in the terms of the Roman dictatorship. They were elected for 6 months at a time by the Senate, and it could be renewed, but it had to be the Senate that authorized it. And if the dictator did not step down at the end of his term when it expired, it was actually the obligation of all Roman males to kill the dictator. Mm-hmm. And anybody who had the opportunity to do so and didn't, also fell under that because they were assumed to be committing conspiracy to overthrow the Republic. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a cool idea, actually.
Well, on the happy, happy note of tyrannicide or regicide, let's go to the end of show wrap up before we get ourselves into too much more trouble.
The email address for the podcast, where you can send feedback, comments, suggestions. Please don't send your pot recipes. I don't want them. Or political theories. You can send those
to... Just send the regular brownie recipe. That's all we're interested in. We don't want the pot brownie recipe, just the regular brownies.
Just double fudge with macadamia. Those are the best kind. Send that to podcast@barnhart.biz. Masses for Anne's benefactors are every single day. And once a week, there's a mass for everybody who died the previous week, a requiem mass, that is. Please join your prayers with all the priests who offer these masses. They definitely are high on Satan's hit list. Please pray for them. They need our prayers.
And if there are any priests listening who would be willing to be a Barnhart benefactor mass or requiem mass celebrant, shoot me an email. If you are willing to commemorate either my benefactors or do the requiem once a week, say a requiem once a week, let me know, because I think I mentioned this before on the podcast, Father Requiem is no spring chicken, and he has asked that I pre-prepare for the time when he is not able to reliably offer the Requiem Mass every week. He had a little bit of a health scare. So anybody out there listening who wants to get on board and do that, please let me know.
I guess it would be prudent for Father Requiem to make sure that somebody's offering a Requiem for him as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So yes, podcast@barnhart.biz or Anne@barnhart.biz for if you are a priest who wants to fill in on that point. The Barnhart Podcast is a production of Super Nerd Media. If you found something of value in this or previous episodes and would like to return some value, please visit supernerdmedia.com for more details, which is what Camille, Brian, Donald, Blaine all did via PayPal, and Richard via the mailbox. And actually, nobody sent anything in for Tiny Princess, but I'm going to mention Shipmate JS one more time because he was the last one to do that. Visited the sisters who took care of her overnights. this last weekend, and they're a real treat to visit, and it's a great order, and definitely worth supporting. And I will let you talk about Matthew 17:20.
Matthew 17:20 intention is fasting at least twice a week, and of course daily prayer. The intention is that the Bergoglian anti-papacy be fully publicly exposed and nullified, that Pope Benedict XVI Ratzinger be publicly recognized as having been the one and only living pope since April of 2005, that Bergoglio revert to Catholicism, die in a state of grace, and eventually someday achieve the beatific vision, and likewise Pope Benedict repent of what he has done, die in a state of grace, and someday achieve the beatific vision. So full fast twice a week if you can, but you know, obviously just pray.
Absolutely. And until next time, I am Super Nerd.
And I'm Ann. Thanks, guys. God bless.